Call the House Judiciary Committee to order Wednesday, May 4th, 2011. We're going to start at the top of the agenda and go right down. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 379. Staff?
Chairs and members of the committee, Senate Bill 379 allows active members of the Oregon State Bar to file statements of candidacy for positions on the Bar's Board of Governors and House of Delegates, declares an emergency effective on passage. It comes from the Board of Governors section of the Oregon State Bar. Candidates must currently, for the Board of Governors and House of Delegates, have to file a nominating petition signed by 10 members, and so this bill would replace that requirement.
Sylvia, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee. My name is Sylvia Stevens. I'm here today as the Executive Director of the Oregon State Bar. As was explained, the purpose of SB 379 is to streamline the process by which we elect members of the Board of Governors and also the House of Delegates. Currently, the Bar Act requires that candidates submit a petition that's signed by 10 active members of the Bar, and that's been the way it's been for the Board of Governors for many, many years. When we created the House of Delegates in 1996, we just adopted that same process without perhaps analyzing whether it had any particular value, and it's been our conclusion after looking at this over the last few years that 10-signature petition really doesn't provide any meaningful information to bar members who are the electors in the election. And for some people, especially people in the rural communities, it's actually kind of a barrier to being a candidate. It's hard for them to get the 10 signatures and do all that. So this would repeal that provision and allow candidates to nominate themselves with just their own signature. So we would ask your support for the bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Just one question, Sylvia. I want to just make it a public record. It seems strange that this isn't done within the House, within the bar itself. Can you talk to us about how it got into statute rather than kind of in-house?
It predates my time at the bar. It's been part of the Bar Act for a long, long time. The structure for the Board of Governors has been there probably since 1935, and this was always how it was done.
Okay.
It's kind of an anachronism.
Okay, we'll let you off on that one. You're going to be up on most of these, are you? Well, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 379, open a hearing on Senate Bill 380.
Chairs and members of the committee, Senate Bill 380 suspends a person's membership in the Oregon State Bar for failure to file annual certifications or other disclosures regarding lawyer trust accounts, declares an emergency effective upon passage. Again, from the Oregon State Bar.
Thank you, Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee. I'm still Sylvia Stevens from the Oregon State Bar. This bill is a little more complicated than the one that we talked about a minute ago. It is one of those law of unintended consequences situations. Lawyers have long been required to hold client funds in a trust account separate from their own property, and for the last 25 years or so, they've been required to put that in an account where the interest accrues for the benefit of the Oregon Law Foundation, unless it's such a sizable amount of money or going to be held for such a period of time that it can actually earn net interest. The bar regulates those accounts, and we require that lawyers maintain them, and there's overdraft protection for them and that sort of thing. In 2005, we amended the Rules of Professional Conduct to clarify some of the provisions about trust accounting and the IOLTA, those accounts that I was just referring to. And one of the things we added was a requirement that lawyers annually certify that they have a trust account or that they are exempt for whatever reason, that they wouldn't have to have one. And one of the consequences of that has been that lawyers, either the lawyer themselves or their administrative staff, they overlook the filing and they end up in violation of the disciplinary rules. Disciplinary counsel's office has to open a file, investigate what happened. In almost every case, the lawyer files the certification. There's nothing wrong with the handling of the account, and the matter is closed, and the lawyers go on their way. In 2010, by way of example, there were 730 lawyers who didn't timely file their certificates, and as it turned out after investigation, there wasn't any problem with any of these, but it becomes a real burden on disciplinary counsel's office. The Board of Governors and I believe that it makes more sense to make this an administrative matter, so that if a lawyer fails to file on time after due notice, then they will get an administrative suspension, which then can be cured by filing the certificate, and it will all be handled administratively in the bar. We've talked to the court about this. They have no problem in changing the rules of professional conduct to take it out of there and let it be just a statutory administrative responsibility for the bar. And I assure you this won't have any effect on the disciplinary council's ability to investigate real trust account issues. They still have that authority. So I would ask that you support this bill, and again, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Committee, you have any questions? Okay, we'll jump on that one. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 380. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 381.
Chairs and members of the committee, Senate Bill 381 authorizes State Professional Responsibility Board to name members of the Oregon State Bar to investigate attorney conduct and eliminates the use of local professional responsibility committees for that purpose. Another bill from the Board of Governors section of the Oregon State Bar.
Chair Barker, Chair Grieger, members of the committee, I'm Sylvia Stevens, Executive Director of the Oregon State Bar. We're proposing Senate Bill 381 to remove what's really sort of another anachronism in the Bar Act and to conform it to what we've actually been doing for some time. We have long used volunteers in every aspect of our disciplinary process, and one of the principal ways that we did that in the past was through members who volunteered as investigators. They were organized into what we call local professional responsibility committees. There are currently 16 of those committees around the state. Most of them are multi-county, but Multnomah, Lane, and Douglas counties have their own local committees. When all the positions on those committees are filled, there are about 100 members who volunteer. Not all the positions are currently filled. As originally envisioned, a case would come to disciplinary counsel's office. It would be determined that there needed to be an investigation, and a case was sent out to the appropriate local committee where it was assigned to somebody who was investigated, and then the committee would discuss the investigator's findings and develop a report and recommendations for the bar. In recent years, however, as the bar staff has, we have more professional staff, we're doing a lot of the investigations ourselves, either the lawyers or the investigator in the office. And also, so over a course of time, from like 97 to 2007, the number of cases that went out to a local committee has declined from about 130 to 18 in a typical year. What we've done in the last recent years is, rather than send a case to a committee, we send it to an individual on the committee. We get the report back directly from that committee investigator, and that's been very advantageous because the reports get in sooner because you don't have to have a committee decision about what it ought to say. We've also experienced a unfortunate but significant decline in the number of bar members who are willing to serve on those committees, so we don't have as many people available. The Senate Bill 381 will not affect our ability to utilize volunteers because all we're asking to have done is to remove the sort of committee structure from the bill. It will still allow the bar to refer cases out for investigation to volunteers when that's appropriate, and we will retain all the authority that those committees had for subpoenaing witnesses and compelling production of documents. So what we believe this will do is make the system a little easier and a little less cumbersome, so we don't have to recruit people by county or by area, and we'll just have a panel of people throughout the state who will do this. So I'd ask you to support the bill, and again, I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Representative Tormey, a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Stevens, so these volunteers, they're all attorneys?
Yes, Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, and Representative Tormey, they're all they're lawyers who all volunteer.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anything further?
Yes.
Representative Wan first, and Representative Olson next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, do you have an estimate if this is going to result in an increase in burden on paid staff at the bar?
Chairs and Representative Wand, I don't think so. We've been doing it this way essentially for the last few years, and our professional staff has taken on more and more of the responsibility for investigations anyway, so it's really not going to change things.
Thank you.
Representative Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Sylvia, I'm just curious, how many, on the average, how many complaints that you end up investigating, you know, for disciplinary matters, that you get a year?
chairs and Representative Olson. I don't have statistics. I know that in the last few years, the total number of lawyers who are actually sanctioned through a formal process is in the 40s. We get hundreds of calls. It's like a funnel. They start as very broad, and then they filter down, and there's a point at which prosecution is either authorized or not. So the funnel gets smaller, and the number of cases that actually are assigned out to investigators through this process is, as you can see, is really not very big. Most of those cases, well, I shouldn't say most, some of them end up being prosecuted, some do not. You know, the field investigation tells us that there's not any facts to support it.
Follow-up. Thank you. Is there a formal process in order to file a complaint, or can it be anonymous, or is it confidential?
They're not confidential.
Okay.
All bar complaints and every aspect of it except anything that would qualify as lawyer-client privilege is public. So the complainant's letter, it's usually a written thing, is public. The lawyer's response is public. And I forgot the rest of your question. I'm sorry. Oh, formal process. We have a form, but it's really just got blanks to put in your name and the lawyer's name and then a bunch of lines to fill in what you want to say. So we do not require anything formal.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Anything further? Okay. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 381.
Thank you.
Thank you much. And we'll open public hearing on Senate Bill 385.
Chairs and members of the committee, Senate Bill 385 modifies exclusions from augmented estate to distinguish irrevocable transfer of property before death and transfers of property on or after death with written joinder or consent of surviving spouse, and to include property held by either spouse in a solely fiduciary capacity. Permits value of non-probate estate to be determined after administration expenses, allows property held by decedent immediately before death to be included in non-probate estate only to the extent that the decedent could designate either self or spouse as beneficiary, allows decedent's non-probate transfers to surviving spouse to be included in the surviving spouse's estate, clarifies that provisions governing valuation of trusts that benefit a surviving spouse apply to trusts created by the decedent spouse and for the valuation of other trusts, references other statutes, permits will, trust, or other instrument of decedent spouse to control satisfaction of the balance of elective share, applies retroactively to January 1st, 2011, declares an emergency effective on passage. This bill comes from both the estate planning and the administration section of the Oregon State Bar and the Oregon Law Commission. It's a follow-up to House Bill 3077 from 2009, which went into effect January 1st, 2011, hence the retroactive application with a date that matches. That House Bill 3077 was a long and complex measure. It represented almost a decade of a cooperative effort by the Commission to update Oregon's elective share statutes. And this bill, Senate Bill 385, makes a number of technical and corrective modifications to resolve inconsistencies.
Okay, we have Jeff, Melissa, and Wendy come up, please.
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, representatives of this committee, my name is Jeffrey Sheen. I'm an attorney from Portland, Oregon, and I'm here to speak on behalf of the Estate Planning and Estate Administration section of the Oregon State Bar in favor of Senate Bill 385. As was indicated in the Council's report, this is primarily a technical correction to a number of sort of unintended consequences that attorneys have found in looking at the law that was passed in 2009. Among those sort of unintended consequences is that we intended to exclude gifts prior to someone passing away, and then if someone, a surviving spouse, holds assets in a fiduciary capacity, such as a trustee of a trust for someone else's benefit, that would not be included as part of the estate that's subject to a spousal share election. We put a provision in to, because on the probate side, you can take deduct expenses and liabilities of a probate estate, so we wanted to balance that out to have the same provisions apply for non-probate assets. Power of appointment is really a sometimes people have powers of appointment where they can appoint only to descendants and not to surviving spouses and stuff like that. So we wanted to reflect that unless that power of appointment directs, allows the holder of that power to designate it to themselves or their spouse, that wouldn't be part of the augmented estate. And so the whole idea here is just to kind of get rid of some unintended consequences to address issues that have come up as attorneys have started to look at this bill. One of the things we also wanted to do was to give the holder of spouse the right to designate which assets can be used to pay the elective share. Because, for example, elective share, or this augmented estate concept that we have in this new law, reaches out to assets such as individual retirement accounts. So if those pass to people other than spouses, we could end up with a tax consequence that we would prefer to avoid in going through that process. So generally speaking, these are technical fixes to avoid some unintended consequences. And I will close my remarks at this point and be available for questions.
Chair Barker and Chair Krieger, Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director and General Counsel for the Oregon Law Commission. As counsel explained, the Law Commission worked on this area of elective shares for about a decade and last session recommended House Bill 3077, which passed. This bill is a technical cleanup bill, as Jeff Sheen explained, fixes six minor issues that the Commission supports as well. I'd also be happy to answer any questions, but they really are technical corrections just to clarify a few pieces of the bill from the original.
Committee members? You have evidently overwhelmed us.
Yes, then Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, we would request that you pass this with a due pass recommendation.
We're probably going to do that in a couple of days. There's a couple of lobbyists that have been pushing extremely hard. We'll see what happens.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 385. And open a public hearing on Senate Bill 386.
Chairs and members of the committee, Senate Bill 386 excludes property gifted to and held separately by one party to a dissolution of marriage from a presumption of equal contribution that applies to marital assets. This measure comes from the estate planning section and the family law section of the Oregon State Bar.
I believe it's Russ Lubetsky and Stephen is Advanter. Please.
Thank you. Co-chairs Barker and Krieger, my name is Russ Lepetsky. I'm here on behalf of the Family Law Section of the Oregon State Bar. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem. This bill, in short, says that property that is gifted or inherited during a marriage that is left to one spouse but not the other is not subject to the presumption, the statutory presumption, that it has been equally contributed to by both spouses. In essence, that's what it does. It does not remove the court's authority to divide such property as may be just or equitable in the dissolution of a marriage. It simply removes that type of property from the presumption that a marital asset has been equally contributed to by both parties. It's the result of an appellate case that came out in 1997 that I'm happy to talk more about if there are any questions about it. But it is a bill that resulted from the intersection of family law and the estate planners and has the strong support of both sections and we think is not unfair to any party to a dissolution proceeding, and we urge its passage. Thank you.
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, my name is representatives of the committee. My name is Steve Cantor. I'm a CPA and attorney practicing law in Portland. I'm here as representing the Estate Planning and Administration section of the Oregon State Bar Association, which has co-sponsored this bill. I'm not going to reiterate what Mr. Lepetsky has just said. I will postscript it by pointing out that in order to avoid the presumption of equal contribution, inherited property has to be separately maintained by the child. When the case that Mr. Lepetsky referred to came down from the Court of Appeals, it essentially sent shockwaves through the estate planning community because suddenly all of our clients who had provisions that said, I give my estate to my son or my daughter, suddenly meant I potentially give my estate to my son and his spouse and my daughter and her spouse, and that has pretty severe ramifications in the event those kids later divorce. As estate planners, we wanted to ensure that if the children continued to separately identify those assets, that the fact those assets were inherited would perhaps override the presumption of equal contribution.
Does it make any difference whether the assets were inherited prior or after the marriage?
Co-chairs, the presumption applied, yes. The answer is yes. The presumption that assets have been equally contributed to only apply to assets that are acquired during a marriage. A judge always has the authority to divide all assets regardless of when they're acquired, but it's only those assets that are acquired during a marriage that are subject to the presumption that they've been equally contributed to and consequently that they should be equally divided.
Okay. Any further questions? I just want to clarify. So my wife and I leave our estate to our two daughters. We get killed in a car wreck. And then if the daughters get divorced later on, they can say, well, this hunk of change belonged to me. That's off the table for discussion? Or
Co-chairs, that's presumptively correct. Again, and it's just a presumption. The court still has the authority to bring that property in if it's necessary to affect a just and proper distribution of property. But if it's been held separately by the recipient during the marriage and not been segregated into the financial affairs of the parties, it is presumptively belongs only to that spouse.
But if it is integrated in financially, if you take it and it's part of everything else you're doing, then it would presumably not count as just hers?
Then it would presumptively have been equally contributed to and presumptively be equally shared.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Co-Chair, so we're increasing judicial discretion here in regards to this question, right?
Co-chairs and Representative Hicks, I'm not sure we're increasing judicial discretion. Judicial discretion, I think, remains constant. What we're doing is changing the presumption that property acquired during a marriage by inheritance is automatically deemed to be marital property and, subject to countervailing circumstances, ought to be divided 50-50. I don't think, though, that we're actually taking discretion away from the court to still do what the court thinks is right.
I mean, it seems like now the court doesn't have a presumption to work around, and basically it can equitably allocate resources in a little bit more. Is that accurate?
Follow-up. Well, the court does have a statutory presumption that property inherited during the course of a marriage is marital property, and that presumption is that it's probably going to be divided 50-50. The case that we're referring to indicated that the husband's mother's will that said, I leave my property to my son, was insufficient to rebut that presumption. And that's the problem that we practitioners had to face.
How did the judge come to an obvious improper decision?
Co-chair Crater,
what the intent was. I won't make you answer that.
That's a subjective question I'd prefer not to address.
Maybe I can get Paul Jimenez or Judge Brewer over here to talk to you. Any further questions? Thank you. We have four people signed up. There's three chairs. If you do want to come up together, you can. Have Lane Shetterly, Jeff can come back up again. Linda and Melissa, please.
Chairs and members of the committee, did you want that?
We'll open the public hearing on 387.
Senate Bill 387 revises the Uniform Income and Principal Act, clarifies that individual retirement account or similar retirement plan held by trust established for surviving spouse's benefit, qualifies for federal estate tax marital deduction, provides formula for calculating amounts trust must distribute to beneficiaries and amounts that trust may use to pay taxes when the trust is required to pay taxes on entity in which trust owns interest. There's an emergency is effective on passage. The revisions to Uniform Income and Principal Act were developed and adopted in 2008 by the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws. Uniformity among the states is desirable due primarily, I believe, to tax implications. A work group was organized in Oregon to consider the revisions, and this group consisted of accountants, professional fiduciaries, bank representatives, and attorneys. This bill amends Oregon's Uniform Income and Principal Act, consistent with the revisions adopted at the national level, and is submitted jointly by the Estate Planning Section of the Oregon State Bar and the Oregon Society of Certified Public Accountants and the Oregon Bankers Association.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Lane Shatterly, pleasure to be here with you this afternoon. I'll be real brief. I'm only here to introduce the rest of the panel, really. I'm here in my capacity today as a member, a commissioner from Oregon to the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws that promulgated this 2008 amendment to the Uniform Principal and Income Act. As counsel said, we have the Uniform Principal and Income Act. It's been adopted in 41 states. Oregon has adopted it, but over the years, of course, the real world of investment changes, and so as the real world of investment changes, then laws relating to the allocation of principal and interest among those investments also needs to evolve, and also evolve in response to interpretations of federal tax law that often influence this area. So this the 2008 amendment was adopted by the Uniform Law Commission with recommendation then to go to the states to be adopted by each of the states to bring their current Uniform Principal and Income Act law statutes into uniformity with these revisions. So you know this 2008 amendment has already been adopted in 20 states. And it's under consideration in four states this year. So this is getting quick action by the states. I think it indicates the sort of the common sense approach to this arcane area of the law, but the need to have this update and for our statutes to be kept uniform with the other states that have already adopted and will be adopting these 2008 amendments to the Uniform Principal and Income Act. Thank you.
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, members, representatives of the committee. Once again, my name is Jeff Sheen. I'm an attorney from Portland, Oregon. I chaired a work groups committee consisting of attorneys, accountants, and professional fiduciaries to review the Uniform Law Commission proposal, discuss the ramifications in terms of how it should be handled here in Oregon and whether or not we wanted to adopt it. Our work group concluded that we should, and as a result of that effort, this bill is sponsored by the Oregon State Bar, State Planning and State Administration Section, the Oregon Bankers Association, and the Oregon Society of CPAs. They've all carried this through their boards for approval. I'm going to speak to Section ORS 129.355, which is the first section that's in the revision. And essentially what that does is adopt, again, this bill is a technical correction bill, but it adopts the safe harbor provisions that have been promulgated for the IRS for retirement assets or IRA distributions that are payable to marital trusts. The long and the short of all of that is that by putting these provisions in place, we now have at least a safe harbor revision that would allow IRAs, which are payable to marital trusts, for that trust to continue to qualify for a marital deduction. What's that mean? Well, it means that when this goes through an estate, this asset is generally something that is deemed to be for the benefit of the surviving spouse, and during the surviving spouse's lifetime, this would not be subject to additional estate tax until the surviving spouse passes away. With that, I will conclude my remarks and yield to the CPA and the fiduciaries who will discuss the other aspects.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and Chair Krueger. My name is Melissa Wall, and I'm a CPA in Portland, and I'm representing the work group that approved this bill to come to before you. The purpose, I'm going to speak to ORS 129.420. The purpose of this amendment is to allow trusts to retain enough cash to pay taxes on income reported to them by pass-through entities. This would be partnerships and S-corporations. Under the current law, if the trusts hold an interest in a pass-through entity, they may wind up distributing all available cash and not have enough left to pay the tax on the income reported on the pass-through entity on the K-1. There are two guiding principles behind this issue. Some trusts require all accounting income to be distributed to the beneficiaries. These are called simple trusts or mandatory income trusts. So the cash distributions that they receive from the pass-through entities are then considered accounting income, and they must be distributed to the beneficiaries. And so that leaves them without the cash to actually pay the taxes. So for instance, if a partnership distributes $40,000 to a trust, and then they give a K-1 that has $100,000 of income on it, the trust must distribute the $40,000 to the beneficiary, but it still winds up paying tax on the $60,000, the difference between the two, because it gets a deduction for how much it distributed. So there's currently a provision in the Act that allows trustees to allocate between principal and income for taxes, but it's very vague, and it's likely unknown to many trustees that are out there practicing in Oregon. So this amendment clarifies that trusts shall retain enough cash to pay for the tax that's incurred at the trust level on the pass-through income. And this, the policy behind this change is that the Act should not place trustees in a position where they can't pay the tax on the trust income.
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, all representatives on the committee. My name is Linda Thomas Bush. I'm a senior trust officer at U.S. Bank. My office is in Eugene, Oregon. I am here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. U.S. Bank is the fifth largest banking institution in the United States, and we have trust offices throughout Oregon. We prepare in excess of 1,500 trust returns for just Oregon accounts. We have our own in-house tax department that does those returns. You've heard about some of the changes. I'm going to speak more from an administrative aspect. These changes allow us on the front line with the client to better be able to explain some of our actions. It provides a formula for the distribution of some of the income and just further clarifies some of the current language in the Uniform Income and Principal Act. Lane Shetterly said, there are several states who have already adopted it, so it just keeps us up to date with the pertinent portions of the Uniform Act and keeps things current for Oregon, makes administration a little simpler for bank trust departments. These changes have been reviewed by most, if not all, of the bank trust departments in Oregon and does have their support. So we ask for your support also.
Committee, you have any questions? You haven't been dazzled, have you?
Representative for Co-Chair Krieger and Co-Chair Barker and members of the committee, I filed 10 pages of additional written material, not so much for you to read, but just to become part of the legislative history of this bill. Specifically, it's the commentary from the Uniform Law Commission about these revisions, and also we're proposing, and the legislature doesn't title statutes, but we're just suggesting that since this is a uniform law bill, let's tie it to the references from the Uniform Act to the statutory headings so that it's easier for people to track. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 387. We have, now tomorrow, going over to Memorial. What time? 1? And we're going to go over there for lunch. Those of you that are going, we don't have a meeting tomorrow. Well, I'll close the meeting for today, though. Yeah, we don't have any.